Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up, an ABC investigation exposes the grim reality of how tribal fights in the PNG Highlands are being fueled. And on a lighter note, soccer history for American Samoa as they stay right in the mix for a place at the 2027 Women's World Cup.
We tried to just kill the clock at the end. I know it's not the beautiful game, but you know what? We got the result. And getting two shutout wins to advance is epic.
More to come from Coach Amanda Cromwell a little later. I'm Richard Ewart, and Pacific Beat is coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. First this morning, Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Justin Tuchenko says the Australian government is assisting his country to evacuate its citizens from the United Arab Emirates. This in the wake of the US-Israeli attack on Iran. As PNG does not have a diplomatic presence in Abu Dhabi, Prime Minister James Marape has also written to the President of the UAE to seek his support in safeguarding the well-being of PNG nationals. Foreign Minister Tuchenko says any war is regrettable, but Papua New Guinea is offering moral support to the citizens of Israel and the United States.
All we want in Papua New Guinea is peaceful, harmony society where our people can live without fear and without favour in a safe and sound environment, free of war and free of harm. What America and Israel have done is a situation in the Middle East which they can only resolve. And unfortunately, the whole world comes to a very difficult situation when this is happening. You know, Papua New Guinea is only a very small part of the jigsaw puzzle that makes up the world that we live in. And we are there to give our moral support to those good citizens of Israel, as well as the United States and those law-abiding citizens. One thing that Papua New Guinea will not support is terrorism and those that back and support terrorism. It clearly shows that Iran is sponsoring and supporting terrorism throughout the region, their region. But also it clearly shows as well that their nuclear capability was increasing and continuing. And the last thing we want in the Pacific, which has had in the past, is nuclear ambitions being, especially from a rogue state or rogue country, being exploited. We've signed up with the Rarotonga Agreement, as well as many others, to stop and ban and totally against nuclear ambitions of any country that would use it for their own personal gains and means and against humanity. We would never support that. Now, for us, we've always supported Israel. And with that as well, we set up our embassy in Jerusalem as one of the first from the South Pacific to do so. We've got most of our staff out already. We've only got our deputy ambassador with his family still there because the borders and the skies are closed due to this war that's going on at the moment.
As we know and as we've seen with any, you know, conflict and war in any region in the world, of course, for many countries, that first thought goes to, you know, citizens who may be affected in these areas. Now, PNG doesn't have a consulate in the United Arab Emirates. So where does that leave the government in terms of getting citizens out of that region and home safely?
Well, Australia has always offered their support and assistance in this regard. And we thank Australia for doing that and offering not only Papua New Guinea, but other Pacific Island countries their support to assist them get out of a terrible war zone or a situation that might cause them harm. So we appreciate Australia's olive branch and assistance in supporting our residents. Just matter of fact, our Prime Minister was about 4 weeks ago in UAE. And with that, we are setting up a new embassy in United Arab Emirates as we speak. But unfortunately, now we've put that all on temporarily on hold until this situation can be sorted out once and for all.
Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Justin Tuchenko on the line from Port Moresby. He was speaking there to Lucy Cooper. Now, as the first funerals for Israelis killed in Iranian retaliatory strikes have been taking place after a missile hit a synagogue in a town outside Jerusalem, the Vice Chancellor of the National University in Solomon Islands says the Pacific must remain an ocean of peace. Posting on social media, Dr. Transform Agarwal describes the escalating conflict between the United States, Israel and Iran as deeply alarming. He warns that the Pacific does not need more global instability and that if oil supplies from the Gulf are disrupted and global fuel prices surge, already fragile Pacific economies could face another severe external shock. And as the ABC's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports, in just the last few hours, Israel has stepped up its strikes on Lebanon.
As the afternoon sun casts long shadows over Beirut's southern suburbs, Israeli warplanes struck the city and beyond. Israel claims it was targeting Hezbollah sites less than 24 hours after the Iranian-backed militant group entered the fray, firing rockets over its southern border into Israeli territory. Lebanon's Prime Minister Nawaf Salam earlier saying his government rejected Hezbollah's decision to attack Israel.
It affirms that the decision of war and peace is exclusively in its hands, which necessitates the immediate prohibition of all of Hezbollah's security and military activities.
Hezbollah says it's striking Israel to avenge the death of Iran's supreme leader Ali Khamenei over the weekend. Israel in turn declaring Hezbollah's leader Naim Qassem a target for elimination. On Beirut's famous Corniche, the ABC met people who'd fled the southern suburb of Dahiya as it was being pummeled the night before. Among them was Zainab Nasser, sitting in her pyjamas.
The house started shaking. We woke up to see what was happening. We escaped because our apartment is very high up on the 10th floor.
Im Mohammed was also there. She was critical of the Lebanese authorities for not providing assistance to those who left and feared what was to come.
How do I feel? There's a plane above us. I'm scared. I'm terrified. What can we do? We're like everyone else. We don't have the means to rent somewhere else. We have no money.
The death toll from the overnight attacks had risen to 31 by early evening, but that was before another heavy bombardment across Beirut and Lebanon's south. The situation in Iran even more dire after 3 days of intense strikes hitting thousands of targets.
Based on our field reports, our estimate is that 1,500 people died so far, which includes 200 civilians across Iran.
Arina Moradi is from the organization Hengal, which monitors human rights in Iran and Kurdistan.
They targeted military bases. Unfortunately, most of these bases are inside the towns and the cities, very close to populated areas. So we are expecting the number of casualties to rise in coming days.
Not all of those deaths were as a result of airstrikes. Some were shootings by Iranian security forces. It's difficult to get information out of Iran given restrictions on the press and the reprisals for citizens who share details outside the country. In Israel, scenes of carnage and heartbreak as a result of Iranian retaliatory strikes are clear to see. In Beit Shemesh, outside Jerusalem, the grief poured from one woman whose sister was among nine who were killed on Sunday afternoon. Her funeral was being held as warning sirens rang out for more incoming missile barrages. Among the mourners was Sarah Wiseman and her son, Avi.
I think it hasn't sunken in yet. Really terrible tragedy. And she was a special woman. She was a person who gave. She volunteered. She was an incredible mom. and just an incredible human being, a great loss.
My friends are pretty scared. We're all scared. And we have the IDF to protect us. The rest, it's on God. You need to, trust and believe in him. They will protect you.
Israel's President Isaac Herzog visited the site of the strike before the funerals began, and he had a warning to groups across the region not to follow Hezbollah's lead and attack Israel.
And I recommend not to any proxy, not to even dare think that they will start another war with us.
While speaking in very strong terms about others, Israeli leaders are also facing condemnation that these strikes in conjunction with the United States are illegal, that the countries didn't go through the appropriate processes before launching them.
Mr. President, how do you respond to criticism from the UN that this is a breach of international law?
As President Herzog walked off, he turned and insisted there was no breach.
The ABC's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reporting. Pacific Beat. Women and girls are being trafficked to armed mercenaries in Papua New Guinea in exchange for their services in tribal fighting. An ABC News investigation also found young boys are being taught how to fire higher-powered assault rifles so they can fight alongside men. PNG correspondent Marion Farr and producer Thekla Gunga travelled to Enga province, one of the hotspots for gun violence. What they found backs up research sponsored by the United Nations that suggests that politicians and the elite are buying guns that are smuggled onto the black market by soldiers and police officers. Thekla is with us this morning here on Pacific Beat. Welcome to the program. It sounds like an extraordinary trip that you took to Enga. Can you sum up for us what the experience was like?
Yes, thank you, Richard. Good morning. Yes, the trip to Enga was specifically to go and speak to the community, people in the community who were affected by ongoing tribal violence for so many years. And we were very privileged to go and be invited by a ward councillor. He was a former warlord, and he felt that enough is enough. He wanted to see change in his community. So he allowed us to go into his community and speak to people involved in tribal violence, the mercenaries, the hired gunmen from another tribe, and people in his own community who pick up the guns and go into tribal fights to basically fight.
So would it be fair to say that you were given the opportunity to speak to victims, if you like, of what's happening in the Highlands, but also to the perpetrators?
Yes, that's right. We spoke to both people who were affected by the gun violence, the ones that were displaced and living in other people's villages, and also the perpetrators, the people who pick up the guns, go in and fight and return back to the same village and live amongst the ones who are affected.
So in the case of the perpetrators, what is their justification for what they're prepared to be involved in and the lengths that they are clearly going to escalate the tribal fighting?
Yes. The perpetrators say that they are hired gunmen. They have access to high-powered weapons and illegal guns. And because tribal fighting is it's an Engen culture, it cannot be solved through the normal law and justice system that we have in PNG. They have their own rules of engagements. And their justification is that people who hired them, they need them to protect their land and, basically their land and their lives. So when they go into a community to fight, they demand for money. The communities contribute and they pay these gunmen or machineries. They sometimes demand 6,000 kina per week. And if they're there for a month, then it's 6,000 kina times 4 weeks. So they also ask for young girls and pigs. So people in the community have no choice. That's what they told us. They said, if the gunmen wants our wives, we give our wives. If they want young girls, we give the young girls, because they are here to protect the community.
Where are these mercenaries in particular coming from? Are they people who are already within the communities in Enger, or are they coming from elsewhere, maybe from the National Capital District, for example?
No. So the Engen tribal conflict or tribal fights, it's part of the Engen culture. So it's a traditional fight from their ancestors. So what this means is that since the times of their ancestors, they have formed tribal alliances, and they have, you know, certain clans that they all come together and fight. So these hired gunmen are from tribal alliances. So say if there's like a tribal conflict between one clan and another tribe, all the tribal alliances for that tribe that's involved in the fight, they all come together and they fight. And if it means for them to hire the gunmen, then the hired gunmen comes from the tribal alliances.
And to go back to the point that you made about what is happening to the community, and you said if they have to give up their wives, they do, in order to satisfy the needs of these mercenaries. I mean, in any orbit, that is brutal.
That's right. That is the practice, and that has been ongoing for so many years already. There was one of the people we interviewed. He's from that village, Akom village, and he told us that if the gunmen want their wife, they give their wife. And it's they basically have no choice, because the hired gunmen come with those high-powered machine guns, or not machine guns, but high-powered rifles. And because they are defending their village, they need to give them some form of payment. So when we ask the hired gunmen, like, do you feel sad, or do you, you know, think of your own sisters back in your village when you are getting young girls or wives of other men in the village? And they said, no, we don't really feel sad, because that's what we demand. They want us to fight for their land. They have to give us their wife and young girls. But it's not like, it depends on the gunmen. If they want wives or young girls, they get them. Otherwise, most of them want money and pigs.
And the question of young boys being trained to use assault rifles, I presume in most, if not all, cases, that there's no choice to that either. They are recruited and trained and then used in the fights.
Yes. We saw for ourselves children as young as 12 years old go into the battlefield, and they carry weapons, they carry ammunition. Sometimes they are sent to the battlefield to like be spies. So yes, they said it's those children, they have no choice, because in the Engen culture, they have to stand up and fight for their land, because their big brothers or their fathers and grandfathers have already been killed. It is up to them now to take up the weapon and fight. So yes, they are being trained. There was a gunman that we spoke to. We asked if he had any children, and he said, yeah, I have a son and a daughter. My son, I train him to use the gun. So children in Enger, as young as 6 years old, they hold on to the weapons, and they're exposed to the guns in the community. So it's, we were a bit shocked to see. Like, I'm from here, PNG, but I'm not, you know, I don't have access to seeing all these high-powered guns just being carried around in the community. And these children, they grow up with these guns in the community. So they said, oh, it's normal. But when you look at it, it's not normal. But these children, they just have no choice. They cannot, if they choose not to fight, then they are sent back to where their mother is from. So if they want to remain in their father's village, they have to take up the weapon and fight.
Is the question of gun supply and how these high-powered weapons are getting onto the black market perhaps the key to not necessarily stopping tribal fighting, but maybe winding things back a little bit? Because the suggestion is that politicians are involved in supplying the money for these weapons, or basically those who are well off who have the money to provide these weapons. And that's surely something which the government could intervene on, isn't it?
Yes. These hired gunmen and the people in the community, they told us that we don't have, you know, money to hire all these gunmen and buy the guns. It's the businessmen in Enga, and they are educated professionals in Enga. They are the ones that are buying guns and buying ammunition and providing the money. So that's how they get their guns. They also say that in the battlefield, when they kill the enemy, they get the guns from the enemy. And we asked about, there was a report that suggested that police and PNGDF soldiers sell off the weapons to the tribal war leaders. And they said, yeah, we buy guns from police and defense, and we also buy ammunition from them in another area in where the mine is, the Pogera mine. The illegal miners there said, oh, we get the golds and we trade the golds for ammunition in Pogera. So yeah, that's what the people in the village told us.
So if these weapons are emanating either from the armed forces or from the police force, I mean, looking at it from the outside, essentially those in charge of the armed forces and the police force have lost control. I mean, this shouldn't be happening. These weapons should not be being distributed in this way. It's as simple as that, isn't it?
Yes, that's what the Defence Force commander for PNG Defence Force had told us. He confirmed that there's a leakage in guns and ammunition being traded off by PNGDF officers or personnel, the members who are working up in the Highlands region. And he said they're looking at ways to strengthen or close off these gaps. With police, we have been told that because police have access to court exhibits, sometimes it's easier for police to loan off the guns to the warlords and get them back after the fight. So we have all these existing challenges in how people in Henga and other provinces in the Upper Islands have access to guns. And yeah, we don't have like a good data how to sort of to track down which guns came from the police and which came from the defense. And but we have had cases before in the past where PNGDF members who have been found to be involved in giving out ammunition and weapons, they've been dismissed from the defense force, and the same had happened to police officers too.
Amongst all the people that you spoke to, particularly those that are suffering the consequences of this escalating tribal fighting, did they have any solutions to offer? Did they have any suggestions as to how things could change, or are they resigned to just having to put up with this?
Yes. There was one of the business women in Pogera that was not in this story that we worked on, but from a previous story, she was saying that the only way to stop or minimize all these purchase of guns and ammunition is to track down the accounts for all the businessmen in Enga and see how the money is being transferred, because that is how they transfer money and buy guns. And for the women in the village, most of them say they have been displaced for so many years, like they move from one community to the next, and they're being used as slaves again to work for the people that they live in their village. So they said that the only way is for the government to just go into the village and collect all the guns. And that is what the government is doing now. They established the task force. It's called Kumul 23. Excuse me. Kumul 23. So they started going into villages and doing the investigations, and they have like a list of all the people, all the warlords, and what type of guns they have. So they've started off this amnesty period. Last week, Friday, the police minister announced in Enga province that everyone who has illegal guns or guns sold off by police and defense needs to return them. And after a month, that task force team that was established, Kumul 23, they will go into the village and pick up the guns. And if it means to, if the people want to like put up a fight, then they will use force to get back those guns. So that is what the government is doing, and the communities are very happy about it, especially the women. They said, we've had enough of moving from one community to the other community. And also the hired gunmen and people involved in fighting, they said so many people have died, their fathers and brothers and mothers and sisters, everyone in their community, most of them have lost their lives. So they felt that they needed to, the government is doing the right thing to get back the guns, but they want the government to buy the guns because they said they spent so much money, up to 50,000 kina at least, to buy one of those high-powered guns. So that's what is happening at the moment.
Maybe some light at the end of the tunnel. It is an extraordinary situation. And Thakla, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning and recounting your experiences on that trip to Enga, and the work that obviously yourself and Mariam Farr, the PNG correspondent, are doing. I mean, it's so important that people know what is happening in the PNG Highlands and know about it in greater detail so that maybe something can be done. So Thakla, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really, really appreciate it.
All right. No worries, and you're welcome.
Thakla Gunga there, the producer in our Port Moresby team over there in Papua New Guinea. And it really is an extraordinary state of affairs. Tribal fighting in Papua New Guinea has gone on for decades and centuries, but the 21st century version is a whole other ball game, isn't it? And what those people go through up there is quite extraordinary. Thakla Gunga, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of litres of oil into our ocean.
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks, which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here with Pacific Beats here on ABC Radio Australia for a Tuesday morning. It's Richard Hewitt with you on this occasion, and still taking in, really, the extraordinary account from Thakla up there in the PNG Highlands. It is really quite mind-blowing. And you do wonder what can be done to try and turn a situation like that around. I mean, Thakla spelled out some of the things that are happening. But, yeah, we hope for progress in the future. But a lot of suffering goes on up there in the Highlands. We'll change tack now. I think we need to be on a slightly lighter, more optimistic note after all that. And some sporting news for you and some history for American Samoa in Honiara, where the team are through to the final stage of Women's World Cup qualifying in Oceania, this after defeating their Pacific neighbours Samoa by 1-0. A team that had never won a World Cup game before has now won 4 in a row. And remarkably, they're yet to concede a goal. Victory was sealed in overtime at the end of the first half, much to the delights of American Samoa's coach Amanda Cromwell.
Ayana teeing up to Aina. Well, she's gotten past the keeper. And it's going to fall for Patea. Morgan Patea has put American Samoa 1-0 up here. Christian Marcy will just let this go out. And it is victory here this afternoon for American Samoa. American Samoa have held on.
Our mindset was let's go try to win it. I think we early on we showed that we had that mentality. Again, just getting one goal, another team's in it, and they fought hard till the end. They had one off the crossbar, the free kick. So we dodged some bullets in these two games, but I'm a big believer in you create your own luck. And our girls, they were so resilient, and they just fought so hard, and they trusted each other. They trusted the process. They trusted the coaches. And you see the result of that. We really tried to fine-tune some things from the first game. One was possession, like how can we be a little bit more clever on the ball, a little more creative in the wide spaces, just so it's not easy to defend. And we saw some of that today. It was good. I think when our legs got tired, then you saw us like kind of losing that a little bit. Our back line was fantastic, just always being an outlet so we can work it around. Our goalkeeper, fantastic when we needed her to be. And just keeping the ball is the best defense sometimes. That's always been my mentality as a player and a coach, just keep it. And you saw that we tried to just kill the clock at the end. I know it's not the beautiful game, but you know what? We got to get the result, and we did. And getting two shutout wins to advance, it's epic.
Certainly is. Amanda Cromwell, coach of American Samoa's national women's soccer team, now destined for stage 3 in New Zealand next month, where just one more win would secure them at least a place in the World Cup Intercontinental Playoffs in February next year. Wouldn't that be a remarkable achievement? New Zealand, unsurprisingly, are also through to stage 3 after recording another 8-0 win, this time over the host nation Solomon Islands. Meanwhile, over in Fiji, where the other qualifying group is being played out, the eagerly anticipated clash between Fiji and PNG was called off because of lightning and heavy rain in Bar. That match will now be played at lunchtime today, with both sides keen to win, obviously, but especially to avoid a clash with New Zealand in the semi-finals. Before the weather turned nasty, they did manage to complete the match between New Caledonia and Vanuatu, with the team from the French territory winning 2-1 to keep their qualification hopes alive. Well, Vanuatu's chances are not gone, but they would appear to be rather slim now. It's catch-up day in the OFC Pro League, with two of the matches that were postponed during round one in Auckland being played out in Melbourne at the home of the Matildas. Rather busy in the Asian Cup at the moment. Fiji's Buller FC will take on South Island United, and Tahiti United are up against PNG Hikari, fresh from their first win in the competition at the weekend. There will be one more match in Melbourne tomorrow, when unbeaten South Melbourne meets Solomon Kings. After that, the Pro League rolls on to Circuit 4 in Honiara in 10 days' time, where some decent crowds are expected, and then it's on to Fiji in April. But there will be no Pro League in Vanuatu this year, much to the disappointment of fans, players, coaches and officials alike. And no one is more disappointed than the president of the Vanuatu Football Federation, Lambert Maltok, who, of course, also happens to be president of OFC. However, on a brighter note, he says he's pleased to see how the Pacific sides are gathering momentum after a slow start to life as professional clubs.
I'm very satisfied so far with the outcome of the three series. You've seen a lot of improvement from the clubs when they started in Auckland. It was a little bit tough for them. And you can see that maybe the preparation was not really good at the time. But the clubs and the players, they're having difficulties. And I know that not just on the field of play, but also outside of the pitch, there is also a lot of work that had to be done on managing the team. But this far, we've seen a lot of improvement, and especially on the field of play, you see the excitement now is going up. So this is what we want. In New Zealand, we had the opening. There was a little bit of good crowd there at the opening. Then after that, there was no. When we shifted to North Harbour, we were affected by the weather, and also the competition there did not attract a lot of fans. But and also when we went to PNG, you have the different weather there, and then it's also affecting those coming from like New Zealand and Australia. So you see that the players are slowly adapting to different situation of climates. Like in PNG, it hot. Solomon will be hot also. And also here, it's hot, but a little bit moderate, so which is good. The team are, you know, they are managing them well. And the excitement is really, you can see the excitement is with the club and also the fans around. And this week, I'm really happy to see the attendance of fans here in Australia.
You were on the stand watching the Solomon Kings versus Bulla FC. What do you think of the crowd and the turnout at this event?
The biggest crowd I can see, we started with Fiji and Vanuatu. Vanuatu came with a big number. Fiji didn't have too many. But today, the second game was also like Solomon and Vanuatu. They were quite a good number, but I think it was the time. And it was during the time when the workers, you know, our fans are working. But today is really big. Mm-hmm. You can see already the first match. Vanuatu versus PNG. PNG, there was not too many fans. But Vanuatu came, I think you can, just by observation, would be around 300 fans who were there to support the team. And this is very good. And I told them that I said, I would like to say thank you very much to the support. And I told them already that the support is very important for us. And also today, the crowd for Solomon, and this match, Solomon and Fiji are the same. The crowd, especially from Solomon. Mm-hmm. And you can see that the excitement of this Pro League is getting momentum, attractions, and now people, they start to love this professional league, so which is very important for the league, for the sponsors, for the partners, and also for OFC.
Just final question about Vanuatu. What's the plan with Vanuatu? When will the Pro League get to Vanuatu?
Definitely will apply, finish.
We've already applied to the OFC for Vanuatu to host next year. We are prepared to host. We'll have the stadium, the facilities ready, and everything needed to host. It would be really unfair if Vanuatu does not get to host the next round, especially since we've had the biggest fans turnout so far in the tournament.
Lambert Maltok there, breaking into Biz Lama at the end, president of the Oceania Football Confederation and also of the VFF. He was speaking to Pacific Beat's Evan Wasuka in Melbourne.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
With Pacific Beats for a Tuesday morning here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt, and regarded by some as its last remaining colony, Tokelau has been marking 100 years as a dependent territory of New Zealand. Since annexation in 1926, Tokelau's people have voted in two referenda on self-government, with the status quo winning out, but narrowly on each occasion. Now a third referendum has been proposed for this year, so might the result be different this time, assuming the vote goes ahead? Melanie Pukabin, Associate Director of the Centre for Pacifica Indigenous Knowledges at the University of Utah in the United States, is also a New Zealand-born Tangata Tokelau. Melanie joins us on the line from Salt Lake City. Melanie, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Melanie, Richard, it's nice to be here.
Clearly, with your connections and your heritage, this is something you feel very strongly about. But my understanding is you feel Tokelau is not yet ready for a third referendum. Why?
Yeah, it seems that the proposal for a third referendum doesn't have any specific impetus, you know, like you might expect in countries where there are conversations about the kind of political arrangements. And the only kind of impetus, it seems, is that it's a centenary year. Which I don't know is like a good reason to entertain having a referendum in and of itself. I think the big reason why we're not ready for one yet is that we really need some serious conversation about what Tokelau wants its future to look like. And, you know, a referendum can and should be a part of that discussion, but I don't think in and of itself that it's an end. I think it should be a means to an end that Tokelau has clarity on. But to do that, we really need, you know, a robust dialogue with each other, both in Tokelau but across the diaspora, in which we can talk, you know, openly and honestly about our collective dreams for ourselves and each other. And I think one of the really difficult things is that I think that that dialogue really needs to include the voices of women and children in a meaningful way, which I realise is a departure from, you know, the Tokelau way of doing things, the Haka Tokelau, in which men are traditionally charged with decision making. And women and children are generally excluded from the kind of public discourse about politics. But, you know, the world has changed, and I think we must adapt to that. And so I think before we can even talk about a referendum, I think we first need to have a conversation about what we want, kind of beyond that.
And when you say what we want, are you talking about the population living in Tokelau right now, or do you believe that the diaspora should be part of the discussion as well? And then, I mean, I presume they can't vote, but clearly that they should have an input. That would that be your view?
You're right, we can't vote. There's a residential requirement that in terms of the general elections, you must be resident in Tokelau, or you have to be a resident in Samoa, and usually serving as part of the public service in order to vote in the general elections. So no, I wouldn't say that the diasporic voices like mine should have, you know, should be kind of equally weighted. But I think we should be a part of the discussion about what Tokelau's future is.
And as regards the discussion within Tokelau itself, that the population being so small, it becomes a very intimate discussion, doesn't it? I mean, I suspect most people know exactly what everybody thinks.
I think you might be surprised. you would think that should be the case, right? That because we have such a small population that everyone should kind of know what the temperature is, so to speak. But actually, we don't have a really strong kind of cultural platform for having open and honest discussion about things like this. And so I think that was part of the reason why the result of both referenda were kind of surprising, because publicly it seemed like the referenda might be successful. And actually privately, I think there was a lot of confusion about what the consequences were about of each of the choices in both votes. So that's to say, I don't think we have a forum, right, for sharing actually what people think and what the kind of big questions are and how to find those answers, and then what the answers are and evaluating them, which is part of this kind of like suggestion or recommendation that I kind of make about growing a dialogue.
So what about New Zealand's role in all this? I mean, clearly, I guess if they choose, they could sit back and just allow the people of Tokelau to go ahead with the referendum if that's what's decided, and they await the result. But should they be more proactive than that? Do New Zealand, in a way, have to justify their continued influence over Tokelau?
That is an excellent question. I think maybe New Zealand is perhaps being less proactive, or you know, they're not preemptively engaging, I guess, in a discussion about a referendum, because they were pretty proactively involved in the first two referenda. And I think historically there's been a lot of criticism for the way that those two referenda, not how they panned out necessarily, but the way that they happened, because they happened very quickly. And I think there was a lot of confusion about, as I said, about the consequences of going ahead with self-government and free association with New Zealand. And so I'm not sure, it's actually unclear to me what New Zealand's position is on on Tokelau's, on the question of self-determination. If history is anything to go by, I think New Zealand would be quite happy to have Tokelau off of its list, you know, so that it didn't have any colonies anymore. But I think the New Zealand's influence, it feels kind of complex for them to weigh in at this stage.
Tokelau presumably couldn't survive as an independent nation, or could it? And if not, then how would you characterise what would happen if the vote in a referendum was yes in terms of ending the partnership with New Zealand?
Yeah, so I think to be clear, the proposed referendum this year, at least as I understand it, has three options. The first is that we keep the status quo, so we remain a territory of New Zealand with a relative amount of autonomy. But MFAT has ultimate decision-making power in international policy affairs. The second option is for us to be self-governing and free association with New Zealand. So I think kind of similar to the Cooks and Niue. And then the third option is full integration. And that would be, it seems like that would be as an option, like we would just be treated, I guess, as a really far away province of New Zealand. I'm not super clear exactly on the real consequences of what that arrangement would look like. But those are the three options as I understand them. And I think it's really difficult to weigh in on those three options because it's unclear exactly what the consequences are of each of them. And I think, I mean, you're right, economic security, you know, moving forward, if we were to choose the free association option, there has to be a way for us to kind of sustain Tokelau as a nation. And I don't think we're all that clear on what that would look like. I suspect if we were to put the question of Olohenga, which is the fourth atoll, also known as Swains Island, if we were to put the return of Olohenga back on the table, I wonder if that would be a pathway for a more sustainable future if we were to think about being self-determining.
Yes, mention of Swains Island. I think that's a controversial issue in itself. Perhaps we could talk about it on another day, but we'll leave it there. This is fascinating how it might all play out. Thank you so much for explaining the whys and wherefores and what the people of Tokelau may or may not be voting for later in the year. Melanie, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you, Richard.
That's Melanie Pukobin, who's Associate Director at the University of Utah's Center for Pacifica Indigenous Knowledges in Salt Lake City, and also a proud Tangata Tokelau, reflecting on that possible referendum later in the year. It would be the third. The first two went the way of the status quo. We'll wait and see if there is a third, and obviously await the result with considerable interest. And that rounds out this edition of Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia for this Tuesday morning. The afternoon show will be along at 5 past 5 PNG time this afternoon. Hope you can join us then. The morning show will be back at its usual time slot of 5 past 6 PNG time tomorrow morning. And the return of Aggie Tupou from an away day in Sydney, where she's promoting a new service being offered by ABC Radio Australia. Details no doubt to follow in due course. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks very much indeed for your company. We'll be right back.